Now, Kevin is the Associate Director of Information Resources within the Office of Public Health Preparedness and Response. He is a voting member of the CDC Information Resource Governance Council and co-chair of the CDC Enterprise Planning and Review Committee. He oversees OPHPR, information technology portfolio of $20 million, and a total portfolio of $45 million for CDC terrorism preparedness and emergency response funded information technology activities. He is well loved and admired by hordes of fans throughout the nation. And he holds a number of certificates and credentials that I'm not going to read. There's so many of them. So please join me in welcoming Mr. Kevin Iday.
Well, thanks for writing such a generous introduction, Robin. I wonder where you got the language for that intro. Well, good morning, and let me be also one of the many who have welcomed you here to the third annual PN Summit. It is my honor to once again be able to provide an opportunity for you to tap into my wisdom, my knowledge, and my experience, and my lessons learned, and I hope to make sure that you have some fun this morning, as well as perhaps learn a couple things. I'm convinced that one of the best ways to improve our project management knowledge is to share our experiences. And oftentimes it's very beneficial to share our mistakes, because I think we're all wise enough to learn from our mistakes of the past. And there's no exception here in that I have made a project management mistake or two along the way. And I wanted to start this morning by sharing one of the most painful project management experiences from my youth and my indiscretion. And we're going to call this experience the shampoo conundrum. So I want to take you back decades when I was but 15 years of age and I was at project management camp. It was a hot, sweltering summer in Georgia, and I was at a weekend camp. And it had been activities throughout the day. We learned all about project management. And by the way, I will hold my right hand up high and say this story is absolutely true. It was hot. I was sweaty. And it was a rustic setting, a rustic camp, where we had the young men in one rustic building and the ladies in another rustic building. And we had separate buildings that was kind of the shower bath area, where we had the large shower area with multiple shower heads and a row of sinks and a row of stalls. And so I had decided to, before I got ready for bed, because there was no air conditioning, I wanted to take a shower and rinse off from the hot, sweltering heat of the Georgia summer. So I grabbed my soap, I grabbed my towel and my flip-flops, and I headed towards the shower room. And so as I began to shower, I was washing, and as I got ready to wash my hair, I recognized that I had forgotten my shampoo. Poor project planning. So I had to do a quick risk analysis. What was I to do? A, I could not shampoo my hair and go back to the cabin with the wet hair that had not been shampooed. B, I could use bar soap. Now, how many of you have washed your hair with bar soap? Go ahead, raise your hand proudly. How many of you had a pleasant experience washing your hair with bar soap? It dries out your skin. Your hair gets flyaway. I opted not to go that route because there were young ladies at the camp. I could not stand the thought of walking around with dry, and because you have to understand, way back in them days, young men did not use conditioner. Not going to happen at 15 years of age. But then one more thought passed my mind, and I said, perhaps, just perhaps, somebody was here before me and maybe had used almost all of the shampoo up in their bottle and had left some laying around somewhere inside the facility. So as I was dripping wet and as the shower was flowing, I, in desperation, walked out and began searching all the cabinets inside the shower room. This was my risk analysis plan. And lo and behold, as it turned out, I found a bottle exactly like this. A 32-ounce bottle with just a little bit of shampoo left in it. My risk planning paid off. And I looked at it, and I read the label, and it was something I had never heard of, some generic brand, but I'm saying to myself, beggars can't be choosers. At least I had shampoo. So I opened up the cap, and I put a dollop on the normal little small dollop I use, and I began to work the shampoo into my hair. And I'm shampooing for 30 seconds or so, and this stuff is just not sudsing. And I said to myself, wow, this is some really cheap shampoo. I can see why the person left it. So I screwed that cap off again, and I poured a big dollop of the shampoo in my hand, and I began to, again, work it into my hair. And after 30 seconds of aggressive shampooing, it happened. It felt as if someone had poured acid in my scalp. And I was panicky. I was dancing. What can I do? And I got my head underneath the water and began to rinse off. And the pain was beginning to wash down my body. I was panicking. I was hurting. And so I grabbed the bar soap. And I began to scrub whatever it was, willing to take the risk of the flyaway hair and the embarrassment with the girls the next day because the pain was too great. And finally, after 2 or 3 minutes of aggressive rinsing, I said to myself, what the heck is that stuff? And I grabbed the bottle, and I read, and I still couldn't figure out what the stuff is. And I flipped it around to the back, and I began to read the ingredients. A bunch of chemicals I did not read and could not pronounce. And so I said, I've got to find out what this stuff is. And I began to read word by word. And then I saw the three words on the bottle that brought enlightenment. Three words that gave me the understanding of the poor choice I had made and the repercussions of poor project planning and crappy risk analysis. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, I had washed my hair with toilet bowl cleaner. My first foray into poor project management. So let's start with a project quiz this morning. And this is not anything you have to write down. Just answer these in your mind. First, what was the one thing that if not done well causes most projects to fail? If I ask people these questions, 9 times out of 10 they'll say either we ran over budget or we ran beyond our schedule, or we didn't get the deliverables on time or quality. The second question, what project management practice is often most misunderstood? And my third question is, what is the one project activity that has the most return on investment for the dollar spent? And my supposition and my suggestion to you today that the answer to all three of these questions is the same: poor risk management. Let's go back to our questions number one, risk management. What is it that causes projects to run long? What is it that causes costs to escalate? What is it that causes poor deliverability? Lack of proper risk assessment and risk mitigation. That is the common thread that runs through all the things that cause projects to fail. I think that for many project managers, the process and the science, if you will, of risk management is probably the least understood and, if you will, most often feared. And because of that, it's the first process that is abandoned because people don't understand the science of risk management. And for a little investment in risk management processes, it can save your project from ending up costing you double what you originally planned. In my estimation, a little investment in risk management can save significant costs, embarrassment of a project management process, and a project manager. And if you, as project managers, have you ever been part of a project that was slowly tanking? If you will, we're on the project Titanic, beginning to sink. How many of you are proud of saying, I was on that project that sunk? How many of you much had rather written on the project Love Boat? Two of you, I want to go on a cruise with you. The rest of you, you can stay on the Titanic. I'm going to here tell you that I am not the risk management expert of the world. I am just the guy they asked to present some concepts here today and emphasize the importance. But we have to do a better job of risk management because, as you've heard this morning, neither OMB nor HHS is going to tolerate failed investments and failed projects. You have to be on schedule, on budget for our projects. So our agenda for today is we're going to talk about some of the benefits of doing good risk management, the objectives of risk management, the various levels of risk management, and then we're going to talk about the risk management life cycle, which has, after the risk management plan, it has four primary components of the life cycle. It's identify risk, analyze our risk, plan our responses to those risks, and then monitor and control our risk. Now, I will be very honest this morning and say I'm a big proponent of plagiarism. So I stole a lot of what I was saying, going to be saying today from this book. Now, this book, in case you have never seen it before, is PMI, the Project Management Institute, has created a separate credential specific to risk management. Now, why of all the processes in the project management toolbox have they singled out risk management as a separate credential with a separate body of knowledge? Anybody would want to take a guess? Because it's they actually addressed it, and I have a slide on that here exactly to answer that why. Here, right from the PMI website, I got this last night. It says, put on your glasses. Okay. PMI's risk management professional credential is a response to project management's increasing growth, complexity, and diversity. It fills the need for a specialist role in project risk management. It recognizes unique expertise and competency in assessing and identifying project risks, mitigating threats, capitalizing on opportunities, while still possessing the basic skills in all areas of project management. So obviously they think that this particular area of skill set requires some special training, some special credentials, and if you have a project that has, let's just pick a number, over $1 million a year, it may be a good idea for you to have a risk management specialist as part of your integrated project team who can keep an eye on risks. So that's what we're going to talk about today. So let's first of all talk about the benefits of good risk management, how to ensure that your project doesn't become Project Titanic and remains the project love boat. First, good risk management increases the likelihood of project success. And what do we call success? We're meeting the triple constraints. We're within scope, within budget, and within our schedule, and within our quality standards, if you prefer. So we maintain the triple constraint, and we get good EVM numbers. Why is it important to get good EVM numbers? For those of you who have an investment on the IT dashboard, watch the meter move to the red with bad EVM numbers. We hope to increase the quality of our project by good risk management. It will better help us utilize our resources. When you identify the risk, you reallocate your human resources and your capital resources to make sure that those risks are addressed and mitigated so that we don't have overruns or schedule delays later on. How many of you love working on a failed project? I have seen so many good people leave a project team because the project is just not managing well. We all want to be a part of a team where the project succeeds. So in the end, we have a happier project team if we have a successful project. And probably, if you will, most importantly, you get stakeholder satisfaction. How many of you love going to your managers and going, yeah, we kind of screwed this project up. We're 50% overrun and I need more money. Don't they just love seeing you come into your office saying, I need more money? Not me. What is the objectives of risk management? First, we want to decrease the probability that a risk will happen and the impact of negative risks. We're going to call those collectively threats. But a lot of people don't think about risk. They always think of it in a negative context. But risk can be an opportunity to look at accepting risks that provide opportunities that you can leverage. There are two basic levels of risk. We call these individual risks, and this is all defined in the book. And that is where you look at individual work packages or individual elements or individual objectives, and you assign risk to those components. And then there's the project level risk, where you stand back and look at the project as a whole and identify additional risks. Now, it's important to understand that project risk is not a compilation of all the individual component risks. It is a separate risk process in and of itself. So I mentioned earlier we're going to spend the vast majority of our day today during this presentation talking about the risk life cycle. And here you'll see that there's what they call five components. And I'm not really aligning to this directly, but the first thing I'm going to be talking about is to develop the risk management plan. Then we move over to the life cycle, which is identifying the risk, analyzing the risk, planning our responses. And you say, they say track and control as two separate pieces of the wheel, or we call that monitor control in the PMI, but it's the same basic. Now, you'll notice that it is circular or iterative. That's because it is not something that you do at the beginning of your project and then never look at again. So we're going to talk about the iterative nature. In fact, it specifically says, it is iterative. It must be repeated throughout the course. You'll do risk management at the planning phases, and you'll identify those risks. And as you define more business requirements and more technical requirements, you're going to do some more risk analysis. And as you move into implementation and the system security reviews, you're going to identify more risk, and you continue through the life cycle. Anybody that writes a risk plan, throws it in the project management plan, and throws it on the shelf is doomed to fail. And the other thing I want to specifically say is risk management, although some people think it is not an optional process. You cannot possibly have a successful project if you do not do any risk management whatsoever. So let's talk about developing that risk management plan, and I'll integrate this into the EPLC framework in a few moments. But here are some of the components that may be appropriate for your risk management plan. Now, I'm not going to say you have to have every one of these elements or chapters or sections, but you need to look at your overall scope of your project, the complexity of it, the amount of risk in it, and then you need to modify your risk management plan by considering all these other things. Now, one thing I want to point out in this entire list, and I'm not going to read to you, is the very last item, a risk breakdown structure. Now, many of you have heard about work breakdown structures. Perhaps you have heard me talk about organizational breakdown structures, but I wonder how many of you here today have actually created a risk breakdown structure. Same methodology, same process, but it's based on risk. And I'll have an example of one here in just a few moments. So you want to tailor your risk management plan based on the complexity and size of your project. Okay, I am going to give you some examples of risk, and we're going to talk about these. Because if anybody who has presented a project to me, they'll know that there's two things that I focus on most often within my projects. First thing I ask them to explain to me is, where did you come up with these budget numbers? So, did you consider all the costs? And the second thing I really hone in on are risks. And these are some of the real risks I have pulled out from some of my project reviews, and we want to take a look at those now. Here's the first risk. Users may not use this application. When I hear that as a risk, what the project manager is saying to me is, we've done such a crappy job of stakeholder analysis, we have not very thoroughly defined our business or technical requirements, but we're going to go ahead and put the system into production without any hope that anybody's going to use the tool. Okay, first thing you need to do is stop. We have got a big problem. If we don't implement this change, the users won't have what they need to perform work. Is this the risk inside the context of a project? I would say no. This is what happens if you don't do the project. There's a risk if we upgrade the system. Don't know what that risk might be. Don't know what the impact, but there might be a risk. The vendor may not perform. I didn't know vendors did song and dance, but that's okay. The contractor may not perform, the Fed may not perform, the management board, OMB may not perform. So what? What's the risk? These are too broad, they're too generic, they're unspecific. I can't determine what the risk to the project is through these statements. And what you'll notice at the bottom is what is called a well-formed risk statement. But let's get the last one. Funding may run short. Funding's always going to be short. What's the risk? I'm not clear. What's the impact if this happens? What is your risk mitigation strategy? These are really poorly constructed risk statements. And so at the bottom, I've given you the three components that should be a part of every risk statement. First, we must define the fact or the cause. Then we must define the uncertainty. And finally, the possible impact or effect if this risk comes to fruition. So let me make what I consider a bit more robust formulated risk statement. And you tell me if this meets the criteria. While making change to code that we inherited from another individual, we may cause the other code within it, the application, to fail, thus breaking the application. And therefore, we may have a need to dig through the code to fix other problems, which will impact our schedule and may delay our schedule and therefore incur additional costs. did that meet all three of these factors? Let's take a look. I said, what's the cause or the condition? Well, making changes to the code we inherited, okay, the risk. We may break other code within the application, and the effect is that it may cause us to go through and have to revise additional code, schedule delays, and additional costs. That is a better formulated risk statement than some of these you see here. Now, what this risk statement does not talk about is the probability that this risk will happen. And it does have a bit of an impact, but this particular risk statement does not have probability components to it. So, in our risk lifecycle, we've now got a robust risk management plan. The first thing that we said we were going to do in our lifecycle is what, Robin? Absolutely correct. Thank you. I heard her whisper, identify risks. And she was absolutely correct. So what do we do when we begin the risk identification process? First, we want to consider the past. This is where we learn from the shampoo conundrum. We learn from our mistakes of the past. We go through historical documents, our lesson learned. We talk to other project managers who have made mistakes and are willing to admit to them. Learn from our mistakes of the past or the lessons learned. So we want to do an assessment of the present, our current project, and where we are now. And we'll talk more about details of how to do this. But then let's talk about the future, the what-if statements. What do you mean, the future? For instance, if I was to say, Mr. Lide, I would like to suggest a risk related to the future. And I said, what could that possibly be? Let's plan on the risk of the federal government shutting down. And I would say, oh, don't be ridiculous. That couldn't possibly happen. The government hasn't shut down in 10 years. We don't need to consider that as a risk. Or do we? We'll find out in 2 weeks. Then we want to document our risks. We want to identify all those components of the risk statement that I mentioned earlier. We want to talk about the cause, the effect, the things that might trigger that risk, what we call trigger conditions, and some possible preliminary responses to those risks. And this is the thing almost nobody does. Assign each risk to a risk owner. Because what good is it to write down all the risks and throw them in a document and put them up on the shelf and nobody's watching them? Which is often what I see happening. The planning process is good. They have identified risks. They've documented them. They've thrown them in their PMP, and they walk away. And there's nobody assigned the responsibility to watch for the triggers that indicate whether this risk is about to come true. So make sure that there is an owner for every risk that you identify. And these graphics, I know they're not particularly clear. They're not really meant to convey anything other than to fill up the slide to give you some color to look at instead of just being text. But just to give you a visual sense of what some of these identification techniques look like. First is the cause and effect. Perhaps you know it as the fishbone or the Ishikawa identification technique. And that is specifically a diagrammic form of causes that contribute to a given outcome. The outcome should be stated as an effect on the project or an impact statement. The fault tree analysis identifies elements that can cause system failure by themselves or in combination with other risks. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these because this is really where the rubber meets the road, is mastering these techniques. There's a force field analysis, which identifies the forces for change and the forces opposed to change. They call those the restraining forces, and the risk can be derived from uncertain events or conditions and is used to reveal sources of risk. An influence diagram is a node tree, basically, that looks at decision points, uncertainties, and outcomes, and the relationship or the influences between them. So you'll notice in the lower left-hand corner of our right, you have outcome one, which is a node, and all the different things that might affect that outcome. So all these are just ways to help you identify possible risks. This, of course, is not the exhaustive list. There are several other ways that you can go through and identify risks. So I mentioned earlier you can do document reviews or review historical information. You can do a Delphi technique, which is more of a polling kind of a methodology. Review our lessons learned. One of the absolute mandated processes that you have to do is you have to interview your stakeholders. There's no way you within your own project team can think about and understand and know all the potential risks, especially when the stakeholder or the business owner has other political influences or monetary understanding that perhaps the project team doesn't have. You have to interview all the affected stakeholders to make sure that you have done as much as you can to identify risks outside your area of knowledge. Another thing is, of course, brainstorming. Let's just have a brainstorming session, start throwing things up on the board without thought about whether it's a good risk or bad risk, and just start writing those out. And then we'll start categorizing and then looking at the probabilities later on. The infamous risk-based breakdown structure. And basically what a risk breakdown structure is, you start the top line, the horizontal row, and basically you say, let's put this in a hierarchical format to where the first box is technical risk. The next box is going to be managerial risk. And system risks and so on and so on. And then you start breaking that down within the technical risk. What are some high-level technical risks that we might want to consider? And then with each one of those, you start breaking it down further and further until you get down to the lowest level component of your risk breakdown structure. So that's just another technique for defining risk. So now, we're kind of early on in the project. We've identified all the risks that we can at this point in time for our project. What's the next thing that we want to do? Robin says, analyze risk. Wonderful, Robin. She is such a help here today. She's going to hold up the shut-up card here any second now. So there's two types of analysis. You probably all know this who are PMP. There's qualitative and quantitative, and I want to talk a little bit about qualitative today. This talks about the quality of your risk rather than numerical components. So what this does is qualitative risk addresses your risk from a descriptive basis, and it begins to address probabilities. Then it prioritizes your risk, so you have an idea of what order you may want to tackle these risks. You then add all your risks to your risk register, which you see an example of here. And then this begins the basis for doing quantitative analysis. So what are some examples of qualitative analysis? This is probably one you see in the left, the one you do most often. You basically have an x-axis and a y-axis. One axis is probability. Okay, all you PMPs. The other axis is what? Impact. Probability and impact. That got you here, sir. And people take their risk and they plug them into the matrix. You can have a high, medium, low, or you can have a 1 through 10 scale. And basically you plug all your risk into someplace on that grid. And then you have to begin to decide which risk you're going to address, which ones you're going to spend money on. So we're going to do a little trip here today. And we are going to take a trip and we're going to begin to decide what our risks are and what risk we want to address. So our trip is a car trip, and we're going on vacation, and we want to drive to Hawaii. So you know already you're starting off in deep trouble. Does it sound like any CDC projects you've been involved with? No. So we began to analyze our risk. And the first risk, when I brainstormed with myself, it was a long night last night, was I think that one of the risks is that bugs will impact the windshield right in front of the driver's windscreen. And I began to say, that's a risk, is it not? Okay, then I said, what's the probability that that will happen? On a scale of 1 to 10, I said, that's a 10. I can almost assure that's going to happen. Then I said, what's the impact? About 0.5. The worst that could happen is 100 million all hit my windshield in this one little zone where I have to pull off and get the little squeegee and clean my windshield off. I'm delayed 5 minutes. I'm back on the road. Do I want to waste a lot of time and effort on working on high probability, low impact risks? You have to decide. Now, the next risk I identified is flat tire. What's the probability that I'll have a flat tire on these tires that only have 5,000 miles? They've worked perfectly for 6 months, so they're very well sealed to the wheel. What's the probability that I will have a flat tire with these tires? I analyzed, I said, maybe 1 out of 10. What's the impact if I have a flat tire? May careen, may have a car wreck, may die, which would really kill my vacation. You know, I may have to pull off to the side of the road. I might not get the lug nuts off. So I decided that the impact is 9. Low probability, high impact. How much work do I want to spend on mitigating that risk? What's the typical mitigation strategy for that? Someone says a spare tire. I've now taken a spare tire and thrown it in my trunk, and the probability has diminished, correct? Absolutely not. You haven't changed the probability one bit. But what have you impacted? The impact. So these are the kinds of decisions that you get to make with this probability and impact matrix, just to give you a real-life example. Then there's an analytic hierarchical process, which is very similar. It's collaborate preferences for achieving different objectives of the project. Do you prefer to achieve time over cost? Or is quality more important than scope? So you're prioritizing the values on these different components. Okay. So now the second component of our analysis is the quantitative risk analysis. So what we're doing is providing numerical instruments to the risks on the various objectives of our project. One of the very benefits of doing quantitative analysis is it helps determine whether you need contingency reserves. Now, contingency reserves is something that's very hard to do in the government. But contingency reserves is for what purpose? It is to help fund the known unknowns. And from the PMPs, here's the test question. What do you use to cover the unknown unknowns? Did I hear you say management reserves? Management reserves. So we try to build in contingency reserves to take care of the known unknowns. And then it helps us determine which risks, which those high probability, high impact type risks, will contribute most to the overall project risk and answers the question, how likely is success? And you begin to plug in some different scenarios to see what its impact on your project. There's a lot of tools that you have to buy to do a lot of this analysis. There's some specialty training to make sure you can do this analysis effectively. And I think it's the things that I'm describing now that scares most people. Oh my God, how do I do Delphi technique and how do I do this quantitative risk analysis and I don't have the skill set and the training to do that, so let's just not do it at all. Here are a couple samples of some of the quantitative. You've probably all heard about the Monte Carlo, and I'm going to give you a brief description. It determines the value and probability of possible outcomes of a project objective, such as the schedule or cost estimate. And then we have a decision tree, very much of a node type of an analysis, and it specifies the structure of the decision with nodes, costs and benefits and probabilities, and helps evaluate different decisions. So it's a what-if tool, basically. So we've got a project management plan. We've identified our risk. We've done quantitative and qualitative analysis. And so the next part of our risk management life cycle, Robin is about to tell us, is... She's quickly looking through the notes and me. What's happening? I'll help her. Plan responses, she says. Let's give Robin a round of applause. And did you bring me some Dunkin' Donuts coffee? No. Not very good risk planning there. So what is the purpose of risk responses? It helps us determine what actions we want to take care of that help enhance the likelihood of project success. So our responses include identifying the possible responses for each of our risks. First thing we're going to do, we're going to select a strategy. I'm going to talk about strategies in just a minute so it'll help you understand better what strategies I'm talking about. Then we need to resource our responses in terms of budget and schedule and personnel. How many of you have set aside money to budget for your risk responses? If you can't pull out of your project schedule, I have a certain amount of money set aside for these risks, then you're almost assuredly not going to have enough money on the project to address those risks. How many of you have ever had a project from beginning to end work perfectly without any risk mitigation? Anybody can raise their hand and say, never had a problem. Maybe if you had a 30-day project for $15, you know, maybe that's okay, but if you're going to get into real projects, you have to allocate resources. What does risk analysis help us do? Wow, we've got a problem over here. Maybe we need to shift personnel resources to stay on top of this. Maybe we need to shift our budgetary allocation over here to make sure that we keep an eye on these risks. So this is where I'm talking about. It helps you decide on how to best allocate your resources. After you have your plans, you have written your plans out, now you have some possible responses, you need to go back into that risk register and begin to record who it is and what the possible, who's the owner of that risk and what the possible response is going to be. And then most importantly, communicate your risks to your stakeholders and the potential responses. Now, I'm hoping that you are involving your stakeholder in developing those potential responses. because you don't want to decide that my risk in case I am building servers and we get a surge and all my servers are burned up, that my response is to go back to my stockholder and ask for another $100,000 to buy all brand new servers. And they didn't know that was part of your risk. And then you say, by the way, I need another $100,000. Our servers got hit with lightning. And the owner says, sorry. Well, she's stockpiled. They got plenty of servers. Gary, stand up and wait so we know who to come see. Gary's crawling under the table. Yeah, once we consolidate all of our centers, we'll have servers to spare. Yeah, that's our strategy that we're going to rely on, right? So it's important to participate, engage your stakeholders in developing these responses and make sure that we're communicating our risk response strategies to all of these stakeholders in the process. Okay, we're doing good on time. So what are the different risk strategies? I would say of all things related to risk management, almost every PMP can rattle off these four. So what is one of four possible risk response strategy is to avoid the risk altogether. How do you avoid a risk? Well, let's take a trip. To avoid the risk of the bogus is don't take the trip. We have alleviated that concern, have we not? So there may be some decisions within your project is that we're just not going to do it because the risk is too high. There's no good strategy, so we need to think about something else completely in our project plan. The second one, you all know these, transfer the risk. What's a classic example of risk transference? Car insurance, home insurance, but in the project, IT project management, for the government, it is to execute a firm, fixed price contract and transfer all the responsibility to the vendor as much as we possibly can. They are to deliver a known, defined product within a defined scope, within a defined schedule, and for a defined dollar amount. You go over, not my problem. You've got to cover the cost. So that's how, in the government, most often we transfer risk is by basically having a firm fixed price contract. Mitigate. Does mitigation eliminate risk? No. What we're doing is either, and this slide needs to be slightly modified. Now, I'll say I left that one word, is you are going to decrease the probability or the potential impact of a risk or increase the opportunity. Okay, so when you say it, we'll probably add the word and impact in there because it does decrease probability and impact, but it does not always eliminate both of those things. And the fourth strategy is to accept the risk, do absolutely nothing. I call this the bug on the windshield risk. What are you going to do about it? Absolutely nothing. I'll take my chances. It's not worth, you know, maybe you say I'll put a bug deflector for $50 and that would reduce the number of bugs, but I don't think you're going to, driving through the summer in the middle of the day on a trip to Hawaii, I don't think you're going to avoid the bugs. I think you get bigger problems to worry about. It's like how to drive across the water is kind of one of the things I would work on. So the fourth element in our risk management life cycle is, Robin, I'm relying on you, Robin. Oh, Rob's asleep and she's drinking her coffee down there. She said monitor and control. So what are some of the different techniques associated with monitoring and controlling our project management plan? Is, first of all you PMPs that better know this, you better monitor that critical path. Why? No float, no slack. True? Critical path. If something on your critical path goes out, your whole project schedule is delayed. Right? So somebody had to be better monitoring that critical path. You know, it's good to utilize the float and slack where you can. If I kind of went up there, sorry. But you've got to monitor the critical path. That's one of the techniques to make sure that we can monitor and control risk. Track the triggers. Okay, who's supposed to track triggers? And the answer is not Roy Rogers. I'm sorry, I couldn't escape using that joke here today. Only those of you over 40 understood that joke. Those of you under 40, what the hell are you talking about? Roy Rogers. Roy Rogers wrote Trigger, and just for those of you who are too young to know. Track the triggers. Whose job is it to track the triggers? The risk owner tracks their trigger. Who has overarching responsibility for risk management within a project? The overpaid project manager. And there is no such thing, by the way. There is no such thing as an overpaid project manager. Amen, project manager? Amen. I had to back out of that one real quick. Another way to help monitor your risk is through auditors. Now, all of you just love when an auditor shows up at your door, don't you? Oh, auditor, come on in. We have nothing to hide. But that's a great way is to do random auditing of your project and look at your risk log and your risk strategies and make sure they still make sense. Because what's the worst thing is that you set it on the shelf at the planning stage and here you are ready for implementation and nobody's looked at it since. Your odds of having a risk impact your project go up as further into the project you go as you develop more and more business and technical requirements. Have regular status meetings or risk meetings. How many project managers here have a weekly risk mitigation, risk enhancement, risk review, risk anything meeting? It needs to be an iterative process. Risks constantly come out. What is the likelihood? Or do we see any patterns emerging where there's likelihood of a particular risk happening? Once a risk is experienced, what do we call it? An issue, right? Then it becomes an issue. Okay, and the other thing is some trend and variance analysis. For instance, one of the ways that we use trends or variance announcements is through EVM, earned value management. If you see your EVM number going this way, somebody better start doing some quick analysis. Sometimes you'll find that number so far gone, there's no way in the world you can deliver that project on time. Generally, if you're 20% off the baseline, you had better scramble. But hopefully, if somebody's paying attention, you won't get that far off the baseline before you begin to start making some changes to your project. So now, I haven't spoken about EPLC hardly at all. But this is the moment for all of you to pull out your handout, your gift. Now, I'm going to take full credit for last year having coined the phrase, what do we call this? Waffle House placemat. But this year you've been given something new, spiral bound. We like to think we are enhancing our experience in the world. So now you've been issued the Ruby Tuesdays full menu. So no longer do you have to carry a humble Waffle House placemat, but you keep to carry around your Ruby Tuesdays menu. Or if you live closer to an Applebee's, I'll take either one. So if you'll turn to your full performance lifecycle, you see that I've circled a number for easy reference for your viewing pleasure where risk management practices or processes take place. And this is not necessarily exhaustive, but I did a very quick flyby for about 5 minutes of my time. The very first thing, number one, you'll see under the concept, at the end of the concept phase, when you're supposed to have your preliminary version of your project management plan, what's one of the key things inside your project management plan? Your risk management plan, your communications plan, your stakeholder analysis, and all the other things. So this is the first time you have documented comprehensively as you can your risk management plan. Then we're going to drop down to two, and one of the things that you see here is that the project management plan, when is it done? When's your project management done? Project management plan really done? At the end of your project, when you close your project. It's an iterative process. Project management plan must constantly be opened and revised as you revise your risk management plan, as you revise your communication strategy. Hopefully your schedule isn't changing or your scope isn't changing, but there's a lot of elements that are dynamic as you move through the project and you learn more and more risks are revealed that should be iteratively updated. I have to put on my glasses because this is even too small for me. Item three is, I have a cheat sheet over here. The risk assessment, the security risk assessment, basically it's part of your certification accreditation process. So you have a whole privacy impact assessment there, and you do all the risks associated with your certification and accreditation. These should be done in a draft state at this point. Number four is where your security risk assessment is finalized. Once you basically, this is where you have your IT system components here. And number five, you may be surprised about. Okay, we're in operations and maintenance, and now you're telling me I have to do risk management? What risk could there possibly be to my system in production? Any guesses? Any ideas? Any thoughts? Could it be that your servers are old? Could it be that the business is changing and evolving, and this system maybe doesn't meet as many of your business requirements as it did when you implemented it 5 years ago? Perhaps some federal mandates have come down. perhaps the old ASP code that you're using could be updated to a .NET framework, or the old Windows 2000 environment that you're operating your SQL in could be updated to, I don't know, something new like 2008. So there are a lot of risks to consider within your operational analysis by taking a good hard look at, has the technology, has the system, has its usefulness diminished over time, and what's the risk to continuing to operate this when our dollars are diminishing? Maybe we should look at service-oriented architecture. Maybe we should be looking at a cloud environment. So there is a different kind of risk analysis that should take place within your operations and analysis environment. Okay, we're pretty close to on time here. So, what's the bottom line? The bottom line is that if you want to minimize the possibility of your project being a Titanic, perhaps we can move towards the Project Love Boat. Let's all stand up and disco! Okay, sing it with me. So exciting and new. We all look for the Project Love Boat, where we can drink with, what's his name, Isaac the bartender and Captain Steubing. This is what we aspire to. And I thank you, ladies and gentlemen. And now I will take your questions. We have like 5 minutes or so, right? For questions. 5 minutes for questions. You're not allowed to ask me anything I don't know the answer to. And this is also more just for you to make an announcement to your friends, like, hey, I've got servers to give away in case you're in desperate need. So feel free to step up to the microphone or step up and tell me about your trip to Hawaii in your car. I guess I was so thorough that you couldn't possibly ask a question. So with that, I will be here throughout the rest of the day walking around, basking in the limelight. And feel free to come up and shake my hand. Be happy to meet you. And thank you very much.